case is HL versus Department of Health and Human Services, 2017-12-18. Mr. Krakow.
May it please the court. I'm here representing AI, a six-year-old girl with a mitochondrial disorder, which was undetected and was otherwise healthy. After being sick, received a...
Well, this is a fee case, right?
This is a vaccine injury case. This is a case alleging that AI was injured by a FluMist vaccine, a live attenuated influenza vaccine, and shortly after that, decompensated or aggressed under the terms of a mitochondrial disorder, and less than 3 months later, she was dead.
As I understand your theory, is that there were three factors that contributed to the decompensation, correct? The fact that she had Lay's disease, second, that she had a respiratory infection, and third, that she received the vaccination, the flu vaccination.
Yes, correct.
Well, I mean, so given that you concede that the respiratory infection was part of the causation, isn't it your burden to basically differentiate between the level of oxidative stress that was placed on her from the infection versus the vaccine?
Well, the question is, can one differentiate? And that's one of the issues we have with the special master's decision. The special master wanted our expert, Dr. Kendall, to quantify the amount of oxidative stress. Her position was that in the past, AI, Alicia, had weathered and recovered from many intercurrent illnesses, including fever. No one knew she had a mitochondrial disorder. She was developing well. She had not even been to a doctor for 6 months prior to the visit where she got the vaccine. She went to the doctor because she had an upper respiratory infection. Her pediatrician determined that upper respiratory infection had cleared. What happened then is the pediatrician decided to give her the FluMist vaccine. I don't think we have to respectfully differentiate. Our expert's opinion was that the combination of factors, and the three factors, but what tipped the balance was the FluMist vaccine. And in fact, we rely on medical literature that was filed by the government, by the respondent, that a vaccine for children with metabolic disorders can tip the balance. And that's our argument on prong one of Alford, that we have put forward a medical theory that's recognized, that's been recognized in this court in the Pallet case, on which compensation was granted on in a mitochondrial susceptibility case.
But isn't this a question of the special master determining the relative credibility of the experts?
Yes, and I know the respondent relies on that. But our argument is that if it was simply a matter that a special master demonstrates that he considered the evidence and determined one expert is more credible than the other, while imposing on the petitioner a greater burden, then that's not sufficient. It's not simply a matter of fact that a special master can analyze. The question is, what burden did he place on the parties?
Well, so you rely heavily on the polling article, but didn't the special master find that even if having some relevance wasn't of sufficient probative weight because it talked about something other than a metabolic disorder? It talked about autistic regression, right?
Right, and we understand that the respondent focused on that and the special master focused on that. Our position is there's really no difference except for nomenclature and whether you call something an autistic regression or a decompensation. The fact is, with mitochondrial disorder, the process is the same. And this case has nothing to do with autism. In the polling case, that regression manifested at a later time as autism, but the regression or the decompensation is similar. So they're analogous, and it's applicable for that reason. So our argument is that the special master's differentiation or dismissal of the polling case is not apposite is inappropriate. In fact, it is, and it's been recognized. And the fact that later the polling child was diagnosed with autism, and that was the manifestation, is really irrelevant. The question is, what triggered the decompensation or the regression? And I think those terms can be offered interchangeably.
Isn't your problem here not so much that there might be some evidence to support your theory, but that we have to conclude that the special master acted in an arbitrary and capricious way when he concluded that that evidence, to the extent it existed, was outweighed by contrary evidence, or that certainly your evidence didn't rise to preponderant proof?
I agree that we have to focus on that issue. Our contention is that the special master inappropriately imposed on the petitioner a burden that we could never meet, and therefore under the law we shouldn't have to meet. We don't have to present evidence of how much stress a vaccine would have caused. We have to show that it's reasonable under the totality of the case, and this is one of our issues, that we believe the special master broke down these issues in such a way that if that process is employed, even under the arbitrary and capricious standard, a petitioner could never prevail. Under Alton, the field is bereft of medical knowledge that explains how vaccines cause these injuries. But under the totality, it was reasonable, and we met the preponderance standard by showing that in a child who had a mitochondrial disorder, a child who had recently had a cleared upper respiratory infection, then got a vaccine, and then had the events of decompensation, that meets our burden, that we've met that burden, and to impose any further requirement, which can never be met. No one has measured how much oxidative stress a vaccine can cause. What we do know in the record is that the respondent's expert conceded that it has some, we don't know how much, and that met the burden of prong one of Alton to offer and prove a reliable medical theory. That was sufficiently reliable. The second area that the special master imposed was onset, the timing of onset. And the leading case, the only medical paper that discussed that was offered in the case, is Edmonds. And we believe we're squarely within the parameters of Edmonds, that even if the onset was the day of, there's some evidence that there was onset the day of. That's within the parameters of Edmonds.
Well, when you say some evidence, didn't your own expert say that the staring was the original symptom?
Not precisely. She did say the evidence of the staring came from testimony from HL, the petitioner, AI's mother. And what she said is, if you credit that testimony, because it was not in the medical record, the testimony was that the mom did not know what staring spells were. Something happened that evening. But if you credit it, she would say that could be the start of it. But decompensation is not a discrete process. And unlike the cases cited by respondent, where those cases discuss onset in the context of the statute of limitations or meeting strict timelines for a table injury, that's the Markovich case, and the White Cotton case, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a totality of the process of decompensation. So it could start the evening of, that's within Edmonds, and then it could manifest in a much more dramatic way after fever that happened several days after the vaccine, 11 days later when AI had her series of collapses that led to her eventual demise. So, and that's in a second area we respectfully submit, that the special master elevated the burden, imposed on the petitioner coming forward with medical literature that does not exist, and then misapplying the medical literature in an arbitrary way. It's arbitrary to say that if the onset was the evening of, that's too soon. It's not too soon under Edmonds, because some of those cases that were discussed in that case, in that paper, were rapid onset cases.
But none the same day.
not maybe not in the same day, but soon after. And to say it's the same day, that's too soon, would fall in the inflexible category that was the subject of this court's decision in Powell. It's a different situation, different timeline, not necessarily a hard and fast rule, but imposing a judgment on the facts that was too soon. Why is that too soon? This child had three, as Your Honor pointed out at the beginning, three stressors. And it's well known in medicine that an anamnestic response, we're not talking about it here, but by analogy, could cause onset sooner. We don't know the answer to that, but it's reasonable that she would manifest some evidence of decompensation. But then she started to recover. And then 11 days after the vaccine, which is squarely within the parameters of Edmonds, when it makes perfect sense as a logical sequence of cause and effect, then she had the major decompensation. But it by no means undermines our position that she had some evidence on the night of, and then she was fine for a few days and appeared to recover to the point where 11 days later she could return to school when she had her clear major decompensation that she did not recover from. So in that way, we respectfully submit that the special master elevated the burden for petitioner there as well, also requiring medical literature, which does not exist and we don't have to produce under often. But looking at the totality, we would argue that the special master was arbitrary and capricious in imposing those kinds of requirements on the petitioner.
We can save the rest of your rebuttal time. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Coleman. I represent the appellee, Secretary of Health and Human Services. This is a tragic case, as Petitioner's Counsel already alluded to. AI had a horrific condition, Lee disease, which almost inevitably leads to very sad and tragic decompensation and eventual passing, as happened here. However, the special master thoroughly addressed all of petitioner's arguments and reasonably concluded that on the basis of those arguments, petitioner had not met her burden to demonstrate that the vaccine played any causal role in the decompensation or eventual passing.
Starting where your friend on the other side left off, I have a real hard time with the temporal analysis. I mean, there's nothing in the literature that said there can't be any symptoms that appear on the day of, and the key symptoms did appear squarely within the Edmonds study time parameter. So to say that there's just no sufficient showing on the temporal prong seems to me, even under the most lenient standard of view, to be kind of crazy.
Well, the first thing I would like to know about the timing mechanism is the Edmonds study that has already been alluded to dealt solely with an infection as a potential cause and gave the time frames of what would be expected after an infection, not a vaccination. So actually there's no evidence regarding a time period pertinent to vaccination at all. So that's the first consideration. The second consideration is that although it could be argued that there, if you just take the timing and remove the fact that there's no link to vaccination, if you just took the timing element from the Edmonds case and looked solely at that, it's possible that one could argue that there is trace support for potentially having onset within hours, as three of the 13 individuals studied in that study did suffer from decompensation in the first 3 days or so. But simultaneously, that evidence would further support infection as the cause because infection fit within the majority of the individuals studied in that particular Edmonds paper to demonstrate that the onset period, as here, 2, 3, 4 days onset period that we have here, fits within the majority of those individuals in the Edmonds study.
But you agree that she had three potential stressors, correct? All of which, under the literature, could conceivably lead to problems, including her decompensation.
No, I don't agree with that respectfully. I don't. There's no support in the literature at all for a vaccine playing a role here. So I don't believe there's really any support for that assertion. Certainly there's clear support for the infection being. That's a known. Both experts here actually completely agree that that is a known trigger of decompensation in individuals who have Lyme disease. So that is certainly a factor. But both experts also agree that no identifiable trigger is even necessary. This is that tragic of a condition, unfortunately.
Can you clarify something? I think Mr. Krakow referred to the infection having cleared. I think he said that. I think he was referring to at the time that the FluMist vaccine was given. Can you just clarify what the findings are and what the evidence is
Certainly.
In that regard?
Certainly. So at the time that AI was administered the FluMist vaccine, she had a temperature of 100.3. Earlier in the day, she had a temperature of 100.2, and her symptoms have been reported, infectious illness type symptoms, for the previous couple days. So it's definitely possible that it was in the process, the illness was in the process of recovery, but certainly not fully recovered if she was at 100.3, or probably not fully recovered if at 100.3. But the Edmonds study not only indicates that the majority of individuals suffered the onset of their decompensation in the 3 to 7 day window after infectious insult, but also at the same time that the infection was resolving. So that's perfectly consistent with an infection being a trigger, that timing mechanism there. And to address your point more specifically, I think resolving would probably be an accurate way to put it. I don't think
resolving as a process rather than cleared as a completed phenomenon.
I think that's accurate.
So what the polling information, part of what the polling study, part of what my problem is that the study doesn't say it could only that the wild flu virus could only have an effect on someone whose ultimate regression has to do with autism. It says that the wild flu virus can be a trigger. So why is that completely irrelevant?
There are a number of reasons why that's of little to no evidentiary value here. And I think, first and foremost, autistic regression, as Dr. McCandless, a respondent's expert, testified in this case, autistic regression is something altogether different from metabolic decompensation that we're dealing with here. So that's the first reason why it doesn't
well,
necessarily...
Well, of course. Happen. I mean, if the wild flu vaccine can be a trigger for illnesses, there might be different illnesses that would result, but that doesn't mean that there isn't an indication that the wild flu vaccine can be dangerous.
Potentially, but as the special master indicated, it's not sufficient for purposes of determining whether petitioners met the preponderant evidence standard here, to say that a certain vaccine or an infection causing X is the same as an infection causing Y or the vaccine causing Y, unless X and Y can be shown to have sufficient commonality to draw that conclusion. So here, although perhaps in some abstract sense it could provide some trace evidence, it's not actually pertinent to the individual here, and it's not pertinent to the condition that was suffered here. So that's why I believe the special master found that it was simply not supportive of petitioner's claim.
What's your response to the argument that when you're talking about something like Lyme disease that is extremely rare and there is no science, no hard science with respect to all the triggers for the decompensation, aren't you putting a burden on the petitioner to basically prove the unknown?
I don't believe so. I think the special master here in this particular case gave every opportunity to petitioner to prove her case, primarily through circumstantial means. On page 27 of the special master's decision, and which is page 27 of the appendix, the special master specifically indicated that petitioner's expert, Dr. Kendall, was attempting to put forward a circumstantial case, and that is completely permissible under the Vaccine Act. He's completely willing to consider that. He then went through thoroughly each of the arguments put forth by Dr. Kendall, the circumstantial arguments, to address if any of those had any particular support for petitioner's position, and he simply found that they did not. But I think he gave every opportunity to petitioner to prove her case, even though it's understood that the science is in its infancy here regarding this issue. But that, of course, also is why the burden is only preponderant evidence, to take that into consideration as well, that petitioners should not be held to any higher burden than that to attempt to make their case.
Can you address something that I think I also heard Mr. Krakow say, that something to the effect that while autism is a different consequence of a certain kind of insult to that affects the mitochondria, that there's a common mechanism of action between this case and the autism case discussed in the literature?
Yes, certainly. And I believe that was addressed at least in part on page 20 of the appendix, footnote 15, where the special master addresses Dr. McCandless addressing this type of issue and says that although the mechanism of autistic regression is not known, the regression and mitochondrial decompensation in Lee disease results in nerve loss that's visible on the MRI. This is the kind of thing that is picked up on in imaging, and clearly some different mechanism is at play here. So I believe it would be inaccurate to say that we have the same underlying or initial triggering mechanism happening in autism as we would in a situation like Lee disease, where clearly the manifestation is different at times early in the going when this is starting to develop, and when particularly regarding autism, very little is known about what the mechanism is, and Dr. McCandless is testifying to that fact. So I think certainly, I think that Dr. McCandless clarified it there, and I think as well that the special master's drawing of inferences from that are at a minimum plausible, if not correct, and therefore respondent respectfully requests that this court affirm.
Didn't Dr. McCandless concede that a fever increases metabolic need, and that therefore, I mean, that's one of the reasons that they don't recommend flu vaccines to anyone who's got any kind of illness, right?
I don't know if that's exactly why they that it's contraindicated in that instance, but I do know that it is contraindicated to give certain vaccines to individuals when they are severely ill.
Well, any kind of illness. Even CVS won't give you a vaccine if you're ill, right?
I believe this was addressed to a small degree in the testimony here, and that neither expert said that it was improper to administer the vaccine in this instance, and AI had a 100.
Right, but Dr. McCann has conceded that administering a vaccine in this instance, whether it's improper or not, could increase the risk.
I don't believe that he conceded that, no. I think he said that it's possible that it would cause some uptick in metabolic need, but Dr. Kendall illustrates this point perfectly in the transcript, where she said that metabolic demand, an increase in metabolic demand, is something that happens all the time. I think this is something that happens with almost everything that we do, and that's kind of what Dr. Kendall, petitioner's expert, is testifying there to. And therefore, Dr. McCandless indicating that, yes, it's possible that the vaccine would cause some uptick in metabolic need, it just demonstrates his candor to the court. He then goes on to indicate not enough, in his opinion, to actually play some material role or to be any injurious factor or to bring about any particular condition he's aware of, specifically not AI's condition here.
What more could the petitioner have done in these circumstances?
To be honest, I don't know exactly. I think perhaps the vaccine just had nothing to do with it, and therefore there's no further evidence that would support the claim. And I think in some instances that just may happen. Or perhaps some different theory could have been espoused. I'm not sure about that, but all I know is that with the evidence submitted before the special master, I think he gave that every benefit of the doubt and analyzed it thoroughly and considered all the relevant evidence, drew plausible conclusions, and that's why we respectfully request that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Krakow has some rebuttal time, 3 minutes plus.
Dr. McCandless, the respondent's expert, was pressed before he finally admitted, we would argue conceded, that a vaccine can increase metabolic need. And our argument is that that is what tipped the balance. And in fact, I want to go back to the Brady paper, a paper cited and filed by the respondent, which talked about tipping the balance, said a vaccine can cause a systemic reaction, and in children with metabolic disorders, that can tip the balance. That's exactly what we're arguing here.
But Mr. Krakow, you're arguing evidence to us, whereas the factual question was for the special master.
Yes, and we respectfully submit that the special master ignored that and dismissed that without properly considering it, imposing on the petitioner a higher burden. In fact, we were relying on the respondent's medical literature to show what we had to show. That meets prong one, that we have a reliable medical theory. We're relying on medical literature proffered by the respondent that says exactly what our theory is, that the vaccine tipped the balance in combination with other stressors. So it's not irrelevant that the child had an infection. It is very relevant, and that, in fact, is part of our theory. We're not arguing that we didn't have an opportunity to prove our case. We submit that we did prove our case within the requirements of Alford. And when a special master questions and relies on the fact that petitioners did not produce evidence that we could never produce, and which under Alton the court does not require that we produce, then that's arbitrary and capricious. I would go back to the question about it was the pediatrician who determined that the infection cleared. This had happened many times with AI, and she recovered. In this case, as compared to all other cases,
even though there was a somewhat elevated fever.
Yeah, well, I think the testimony by Dr. Kendall, I don't think Dr. McCandless disagreed with this, is that 100.3 is not really a fever in that context. It was slightly elevated, and the pediatrician had no problem giving a vaccine at that point. So while it may be that the infection was resolving, now we added another stressor, and that's the basis of our claim, and then the rest followed from there. On the issue, again, I think I addressed this in my opening remarks, that it makes no difference that we don't understand the process that manifests in autism. That is clearly not understood. What was clear in a case that was before this court, in which polling was relied on the onset issue, and the Schaffner literature that we also cited, and Edmonds, and that's the Powlett case, is that a vaccine can cause a regression. Our position is there is no difference in a regression and decompensation. It's different words for the same thing. It's a matter of how it manifests. And we think that's a distinction without a difference. And that, in fact, the manifestation here can be identified because Leigh disease has been described in terms of brain lesions and so on. Autism is not. But what's clear is that the process of decompensation can be triggered by a vaccine. That was established in Palak, a compensated case that was on appeal on the onset issue primarily, in which all this literature was credited. Now, the literature was credited, and somehow it's not. Palak was not an autism case. Palak was a mitochondrial decompensation case manifesting in a different way.
Mr. Krakow. Your red light has been on for a while.
Thank you very much.
We'll take the case under advisement.